I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Kevin Young writes in the introduction to his new anthology, African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song, quote, "For 250 years, African Americans have written and recited and published poetry about beauty and injustice, music and muses, Africa and America, freedoms and foodways, Harlem and history, funk and opera, boredom and longing, and jazz and joy." The book begins with Phyllis Wheatley, the first black woman to be published in the Americas before the country became the United States, and takes readers through key historical and cultural periods to the present day. Kevin Young joins us today on Radio Times. He's a poet and scholar, currently the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. He will soon take the helm as director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. He's also the poetry editor of The New Yorker and the author of 13 books of poetry and prose. Kevin Young, it's a great pleasure. Thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome, and congratulations on the collection and on your new job. You've been a very busy man these last couple of years.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I've been working on this anthology about 6 years now, and so it's really a pleasure to see it in the world and talk with you about it.
Well, it's a pleasure to read, and we're going to have some readings throughout the hour. Let me just quote June Jordan, who you quote in this introduction to the book, who describes the, quote, "difficult miracle of black poetry in America." What does that mean to you?
I mean, I think she's talking about specifically Phyllis Wheatley, who starts my book. I think, this tradition of African-American poetry in the Americas. There were poets who published even in magazines before, but she was the first to publish a book. And, you know, I think even the conditions of that she had to have people vouch for her, that she wrote these poems. She had to travel, which is, I think, an amazing thing, to Britain to get sponsorship for her book from the Countess of Huntington. And she, you know, made all this writing while enslaved, made this poetry. And as I argue in the book, there's a real power that she has. She writes about imagination and myths, but she's also writing about what's happening with her. There's a lot of, you know, Greek gods in chains and personification of women as powerful agents of the imagination. And that's what she became. And I think that miracle that she created, creating herself, it's one that black poets have taken up as a mantle throughout the centuries. And it was really when I started writing and editing the book and started writing about the poets, I was like, this is, you know, a quarter millennium of African-American poetry. And it's such a rich tradition that I think it's both miraculous, but also shows that struggle and that song that they achieved.
Well, and she even wrote a poem in the form of a letter to George Washington.
Yes, I wanted to include that because, you know, here she is with a British publisher on the eve of the revolution, and then she writes to General Washington, which seems, you know, fortuitous now, but it was a kind of upstart thing to do, and it was very powerful, I think, her navigating these tough times. And the politics of now, I think, are things that poets today are navigating in just as powerful ways.
In fact, I picked out a poem not by Phyllis Wheatley, but by a gentleman named George Moses Horton, a poem called "The Slave's Complaint." And I wonder, Kevin, if you could read that for us, and then we can talk a bit about who he was.
Yeah, Horton was an enslaved poet and writing in the Carolinas, in North Carolina. And this is his poem, "The Slave's Complaint." "Am I sadly cast aside on misfortune's rugged tide? Will the world my pains deride forever? Must I dwell in slavery's night, and all pleasure take its flight far beyond my feeble sight forever? Worst of all, must hope grow dim and withhold her cheering beam? Rather let me sleep and dream forever. Something still my heart surveys, groping through this dreary maze, is it hope? Then burn and blaze forever. Leave me not a wretch confined, altogether lame and blind, unto gross despair consigned, forever, heaven, in whom can I confide? Canst thou not for all provide? Condescend to be my guide forever. And when this transient life shall end, oh, may some kind eternal friend bid me from servitude ascend forever.
That's our guest, Kevin Young, reading a poem from his new anthology, a poem written by George Moses Horton. What I get from that poem, Kevin, is just he wants to be set free.
Yeah, his complaint is pretty specific. I mean, he is talking about ascending from servitude. But I think there's a freedom that he is insisting upon even in the poem. He isn't just asking for freedom. He's insisting on it through the words of the poem. And that repetition of forever, you know, which goes from a question to an exclamation mark and to an exclamation and a real forceful change. You know, he's not in the end asking. He's saying some eternal friend bid me, you know, he wants to be freed. And in reality and, you know, non-poetry, he, you know, off this writing, he was trying to raise money to buy his freedom, which many enslavers said they would do. And then they would regularly not sell the person. It was such a horrible way to speak of it, but this was the fact of the matter, even though the money was there. And so he was one of the first to write a protest directly against his enslavement while enslavement and published while in the South. And it's a very powerful thing he did. He composed orally at first, and people recorded it. He would actually go to campus in North Carolina and record poems like on demand for students there. I mean, he's a fascinating figure. But I think the important thing I was trying to capture in all these poets who were writing during enslavement was they were all writing against it. Some like Wheatley were writing in coded ways. Others like Horton were writing in very direct ways. It all added up to this foment against their condition and against, you know, the system. There's very much a questioning of the values that allows this to happen or that continued or exploited it. And you see that still today in a real continuity of writing about and writing against injustice.
Your title is African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. And I ran across an interview where you said one of the pleasures of poetry is that it's like a good song. You can sit and listen to it a lot of times and hear something different. Has that been true for you as both a poet yourself, but also someone who loves poetry?
Yes. I mean, to me, the best poems are very layered. You know, they are things that you can return to. Some have, like a poet like Lucille Clifton, who I know we'll talk about a bit more later, is you know, very layered. The first appearance might be that it's somewhat simple. It draws you in. Langston Hughes is like that, too. But then once you go back, there's something you discover every time. And I've been reading a lot of these poets, and especially for this anthology, for years. And what sustains me is I still open it up, and I'm surprised by what's there. It was always there, of course, and the Black tradition has long been of a force in American poetry, but I think it's safe to say that something like this anthology, sees the ways that it's really central to our ideas of America, our ideas of African Americans, and our ideas of poetry. Black poets have been shaping that for centuries, and a lot of that quality is through that layered musicality that's also on a mission.
I read a bit about you and growing up in Louisiana, coming from a family of preachers, musicians, storytellers. Just how important was that to you as a writer to have all those sounds, the music, the voices, the stories kind of rattling through your childhood?
Well, my parents are both from Louisiana. I did not grow up there, unfortunately, but I grew up going there every summer and Christmas. And right around now, we would be down there in what we called home. And so for me, there was a kind of doubleness of being there and having all that experience, that musicality, as you put it, and then also the kind of, you know, American dream that my parents were seeking out. They were some of the first in their families to go to college, and you know, went where that took them. And for me, that was, we ate Southern food. We did things that I thought everyone did, but it turned out that not everyone had, you know, fig preserves in their fridge, or pepper vinegar, which you put on your greens, or ate okra. I tease my mom, we ate okra every single meal, even for breakfast, you know. So those kind of tastes and sounds, I think, definitely go into my poetry, but also go into one's view of the world, which I think is of the culture that Black people made, sometimes that was disrespected, a culture that they reclaimed in many ways. And I think you see that in the poetry, too. There are poems that think about food in the book, but there's also poems that think about music, think about musicality in a larger sense, and think about culture. Black culture is so rich, and I think it really reminds us the ways that it's prepared us to think about how that culture works, where it can go, what it does. And you see that from the beginning of the tradition to the current day.
And what do you want readers to take away from? I mean, it's almost 1,000 pages of poems. I'm not complaining about that. It's a wonderful richness to explore. But what do you want the takeaway to be for readers who start combing through these poems?
Well, you don't have to read straight through. I mean, I think that's one of the things that is a joy about an anthology like this, is you can dip in and out. But I also think it's a sort of source book about poetry. It's a source book about African-American culture, but it's also a broader look at America and how America has been seen through the lens of people who sometimes were told they weren't part of America or were second-class citizens, or, you know, and they have a perspective, I think, that reminds us of history. And, you know, at first I thought, well, history becomes important for different poets at different times in this book. But I started to see the way that history was always with us. And especially this summer when I was finishing the book, it was really a time of unrest and, you know, the largest protests in American history. And you could really see the ways that poetry had been thinking about that for a long time, had been writing about some of these same questions and injustices, but also had been writing about joy and pleasure. And so that's why I really wanted to have that struggle in the song. And I hope readers come away with a sense of both, a sense that even in the struggle, there is a song. And even the song, which can seem sort of, you know, like playful poems for sure in the book. There's jump rope rhymes, for instance, recorded by Lucille Clifton. There's also an element of struggle, an element of making, an element of pleasure that is hard won, but won nonetheless.
You know what, Kevin, we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Kevin Young. And we're talking about a new book he has just edited. It's called African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. We'll be joined after this very short break by another poet, Tracy K. Smith. She was a poet laureate of the United States. We're going to take that break and then get back to our conversation and talk more about poetry on Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're spending the hour with poet Kevin Young, editor of a new book, African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. One of the poets featured in the collection is Tracy K. Smith, who has been a guest on Radio Times several times on her books of poetry and when she was poet laureate of the United States. She's currently a professor of creative writing at Princeton University. Her recent poetry collections include Life on Mars, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and Wade in the Water. She's also the co-translator of My Name Will Grow Wide Like a Tree, Selected Poems of E. Lay. And Tracy K. Smith, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back.
Happy to have you with us. We are getting Kevin on Skype. So I want to have you read, Tracy, one of your poems featured in this anthology, and it's called Sci-Fi.
Sure. Sci-Fi. There will be no edges, but curves, clean lines pointing only forward. History, with its hard spine and dog-eared corners, will be replaced with nuance, just like the dinosaurs gave way to mounds and mounds of ice. Women will still be women, but the distinction will be empty. Sex, having outlived every threat, will gratify only the mind, which is where it will exist. For kicks, we'll dance for ourselves before mirrors studded with golden bulbs. The oldest among us will recognize that glow, but the word sun will have been reassigned to a standard uranium neutralizing device found in households and nursing homes. And yes, we'll live to be much older thanks to popular consensus. Weightless, unhinged, eons from even our own moon will drift in the haze of space, which will be, once and for all, scrutable and safe.
And that's Tracy K. Smith reading her poem Sci-Fi from this new anthology, African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. And again, I believe we have Kevin back with us. We're trying to get him on Skype, but we're having some technical problems. But, you know, poetry lives on, so we will carry on this conversation. Do we have Kevin back with us? Excellent.
I'm here.
Okay, that's great.
I can hear you.
Okay, that's great. Thank you for your indulging us with some of these technical problems. I'm curious about whether the two of you collaborated on which of Tracy K. Smith's poems, to include in this anthology. Kevin?
We didn't, but Tracy and I have gone back a long time, and I've known her work, and it's just amazing to see it. And, you know, I wanted to put everything in, of course. But,
yeah, of course.
Yeah, I especially want to include work from her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, but also to include this poem, Declaration, which ends her selection, which is, she can mention to you, it's a beautiful erasure that appeared in the New Yorker before, but I think that also speaks to sort of larger forces at work that go back to Phyllis Wheatley's time.
And Tracy, you've been on Radio Times a number of times talking about poetry and your life. We're in tough times. I mean, this has been a very tough year for just about everybody in this country. What does poetry offer us to help us through these difficult times?
Well, I feel like poetry has given me many forms of consolation this year in particular. One is the sense that the struggle that I feel myself to be participating in is one that others have also borne, and to hear them bear witness to that and to also make space for the joy that they claimed or made or forged has been heartening. Poetry also gives us better, deeper, stranger perspectives on the everyday and the ordinary. And at a time like this, when loss becomes everyday and ordinary, we need new ways of looking at and understanding it. So I feel like poetry has kept me alive during this time.
Absolutely. And I have struggled, I think, like all of us, to find words to describe either the emotions we're feeling or the times that we're in. And there's something, Tracy, that you said I just wanted to quote. Poetry is a language that sits really close to our feelings that defy language. Poetry nudges some of our feelings of joy or confusion or desire towards feelings that we can recognize and describe. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, well, poems are, I guess one way of thinking about it is they're very resourceful, and often they behave counterintuitively. And in that, they find great ways of allowing us to name and identify the befuddling, strange, complex, and sort of like destabilizing things, be they pain or joy, in our lives. Metaphor is one of the chief ways that I think poems do that. They say, okay, this love is so extraordinary that I can't use the words that normally describe love to make it clear. I've got to move into the context of, the natural world, or even the context of something like nations and I don't know, war, to bring the emphasis. that could be useful to describing the feelings that, that I'm dealing with right now. I used to think metaphor was just a way of making things literally clear, like, oh, this is how blue the sky is. But now I understand they walk us away from the matter at hand to give us the tools to see and discern it better.
Kevin, can you relate to that?
Yes, I mean, she puts it so well that I can hardly follow up, but I think absolutely right, as ever, that, you know, metaphors are also mysterious, you know, simply clarifications. They, to me, bring two things that are sort of unlike close together and say, not that they are like each other, but they are each other in some way. Mm-hmm. And I think Black poets often are doing that across this boundary of struggle and song, and they're bringing those two things that seem like they're opposite into one frame and overlaying them. And you know, I think the power of poetry does that so well. It takes this thing that we all use, language, and it makes it strange again. And it also makes it familiar at the same time. And that mix of movements, I think, is something that Tracy really captures.
Well, Tracy, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
No, oh, it's my pleasure.
And that's Tracy K. Smith, and she is a professor of creative writing at Princeton University, was poet laureate of the United States, and one of three living poets, or I should say four living poets, of course, with Kevin Young, who are joining us today on Radio Times. And we are featuring writers who have been on Radio Times, who are also featured in Kevin Young's new anthology, African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. Joining us now is Major Jackson. He's the author of five collections of poetry, most recently Absurd Man. He's the Gertrude Conway Vanderbilt Professor of English and serves as the poetry editor of the Harvard Review. Was a guest on Radio Times about his poetry when he lived in Philadelphia. In fact, brought one of my favorite poets to the studio for an interview, Philip Levine. And Major Jackson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Such a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And you have a piece in this new collection, which I'd love to have you read, and I think will be sound rather familiar to our listeners.
Sure. Its title is How to Listen. I'm going to cock my head tonight like a dog in front of McGlinty's Tavern on Locust. I'm going to stand beside the man who works all day, combing his thatch of gray hair, corkscrewed in every direction. I am going to pay attention to our lives, unraveling between the forks of his fine-tooth comb. For once, we won't talk about the end of the world, or Vietnam, or his exquisite paper shoes. For once, I am going to ignore the profanity and the dancing and the jukebox, so I can hear his head crackle beneath the sky's stretch of faint stars.
Mm-hmm. Major Jackson reading How to Listen from this new anthology, African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. I feel like you took me there next to that man, and this really happened.
It did happen. As you know, being from Philadelphia, there's that bar McGlinty's. I say in the poem, yeah. It's on Locust. However, this poem was published in the New Yorker some years ago, and one of the infamous fact checkers reminded me that it was on 15th Street. And, I like Locust better.
More poetic, right?
Yeah, right.
Let me go to Kevin about including Major Jackson in this anthology. What does he bring to this anthology?
Well, hey, Major. It's great to hear his work and hear him read it. Obviously, Philly has this rich tradition that he, I think, captures in this poem. But I love the repetition in the poem. Again, the song, and there's a literal song, the dancing in the jukebox, so I can hear his head crackle beneath the sky's stretch of faint stars. I mean, what musicality there. And it reminds me of other poems in the anthology.
Langston Hughes.
That he's able to capture Major in this kind of long tradition in just a few lines, I think, is really special.
Major, you live now in Vermont, correct?
I do, and in Nashville, Tennessee now, as of almost a month ago.
Right. And I wonder, I mean, this is not Philadelphia, obviously. Was there something about living, though, in a city or a city like Philadelphia that gave some energy, inspiration to your poetry? I know you went to Temple University. You studied accounting, of all things. But how did the city speak to you as a poet?
Well, it's the foundation of so much of how I kind of understand and perceive the world. And one aspect of this anthology, I think, that should be underscored is so many of the poets, particularly from the Harlem Renaissance on after the Great Migration, undertake the project of kind of recording that experience, recording that particular journey. What is the culture and feel and rhythms of a city? And how does that enhance us as individuals? So Philadelphia is obviously important to me. And what I should say about McGlinchey's, I'm not sure if it's still there, but it was a fantastic place. It was more of a literary bar, a dive bar, of course. And dive bars in cities are legendary for the kinds of communities that they gather. That particular one, I so connect to my early years in Philadelphia because many of the conversations, I still see that jukebox there, kind of fed me and made me the writer who I am today.
Kevin, you feature poets from the Harlem Renaissance, the Chicago Renaissance. Are we in a renaissance today of Black poets? Do we have Kevin? Okay, I think I'm not sure he's hearing me. We'll try to get him back. Do you think, Major Jackson, that we're in a renaissance of Black poets?
Yeah, I do. I think part of Kevin's introduction kind of delineates from kind of the 1990s forward. There's been this kind of powerful wave of poets who have kind of rightly address the issues that we face today, some of the social and political challenges that our country faces, and they're building on previous generations. It's important to note that. However, their particular sound, and that's what I admire about this anthology, is that you can almost kind of travel back to moments in time in which individuals during World War II or during the Civil War, during after the wars in the 60s, you can almost understand and get a better sense of how folks were responding to the age that they were living. And the poets today do that. And I'm just actually moved by this anthology for that particular reason. It might be a great document to teach alongside our Constitution, just so that students can understand some of the nuances of how we got to where we are today.
And I wanted to pick up on something you said, Major Jackson, about in Philadelphia, you know, dive bars like McGlinchey's. You know, here we are having to physically distance, having to do things on Skype. I know you were ready to go on a book tour earlier this year, and that had to be canceled. How do you create that community when, yes, we have, you know, all sorts of technologies to get us connected, but, you know, it's different from sitting in a bar and talking to someone there over a drink.
Yes, and maybe this is the magic of poetry, is that there is a conversation that is had between the writer and the reader. I mean, that's what is so compelling to me about poetry, is that you get the inner life of another human being on the page in the language itself. And that conversation, I feel, is so important to our own individual spiritual growth, as much as the gatherings that also enhance our existence. And yet this is, reading is a private affair. It can be communal, of course, through public readings. But what you're talking about, that connection, it's the poem invites that kind of engagement with another human being. I think that's part of the preservation
of anthologies is that, like Kevin said earlier, you can dip in and out of and travel to Harlem Renaissance poets or 1960s protest poets.
You know, I'm thinking the fact that you majored in accounting at Temple University and now you're a poet, and I don't want to make too much of this, but I was thinking of the kind of precision of numbers and the precision of words, especially when it comes to something like poetry. Is there a connection there?
Thank you for, don't hold it against me. But yes, you're absolutely right. I've always understood that precision and that quest for order as being one of the important kind of undercurrents of poetry. I think poets make us accountable as communities to language so that we can kind of better understand the power of language itself, not only to kind of express our particular feelings, but we particularly see this during an election season in which language becomes, unfortunately, I would say, co-opted to serve political agendas. And I think those of us who are aware of that power realize the rhetorical kind of acts that are perpetrated to advance an agenda that may be harmful at times. You know, so, you know, for example, calling a whole group of people bad hombres, that's a very powerful thing. And I think any poet or anyone who is sensitive to language understands that kind of violence that's done to language.
Major Jackson, such a pleasure to have you back on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marty.
Nice to have you back on the show. And again, Major Jackson, a poet featured in African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. We've got one more local poet to be featured, and Kevin Young staying with us for the rest of the hour. More poetry after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just to recap, it's an hour of African-American poetry. Today with Kevin Young, he's the editor of a new anthology called African-American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. He's poetry editor of The New Yorker. He is currently the director of the Schomburg Center for Research on Black Culture. And come the new year, he'll be the new director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African-American History and Culture. And joining us now is our third poet, Gregory Pardlow, featured in this new collection. He's the author of four poetry collections, including Digest, which won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. His book, which he discussed on Radio Times, is titled Air Traffic, A Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America. Also the director of the MFA program at Rutgers University in Camden. And Gregory Pardlow, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Hey, Marty. Great to be back with you.
Nice to have you back with us. And Kevin, I know we had some more technical problems. You're back with us, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for your perseverance.
Hey,
and Gregory, I want to have you read Raisin from this new collection.
Sure. Raisin. I dragged my 12-year-old cousin to see the Broadway production of A Raisin in the Sun because the hip-hop mogul and rapping bachelor Diddy played the starring role. An aspiring rapper gave my cousin his last name and the occasional child support, so I thought the boy would geek to see a pop hero in the flesh as Walter Lee. My wife was newly pregnant, and I was rehearsing, like Diddy, swapping fiction, surrendering his manicured thug persona for a more domestic performance. My cousin mostly yawned throughout the play, except the moment Walter Lee's tween son stiffened on stage, as if wrapped by the sound of a roulette ball. Scene. No one breathes as Walter Lee vacillates, uncertain of obsequity or indignation, after Lindner offers to buy the family out of the house they've purchased in the all-white suburb. Walter might kneel to accept, but he senses the tension in his son's gaze. I was thinking, for real though, what would Diddy do? Get rich or die trying, 50 Cent would tell us. But my father would sing like Ricky Skaggs, "Don't get above your raisin," when as a kid, I vowed to be a bigger man than him. That oppressive fruit dropped heavy as a medicine ball in my lap, meant to check my ego. And I imagine generations wimpling in succession, like the conga marching raisins that sang Marvin's hit song. It's silly, I know. Outside the theater, my cousin told me when Diddy was two, they found his hustler dad draping a steering wheel in Central Park, a bullet in his head. I shared what I knew of Dreams Deferred and Marvin Gaye. When asked if he loved his son, Marvin Sr. answered, "Let's just say I didn't dislike him." Beneath the bling of many billion diodes, I walked beside the boy through Times Square as if anticipating a magic curtain that would rise, but only one of us would get to take a bow.
Gregory Pardlow reading his poem Raisin from this new collection, African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. A lot about fathers and sons in that poem. And I know, Gregory, from interviewing you about your memoir, that you and your father had this very complicated and at times very difficult relationship as well.
That's true, yeah. That wasn't the relationship with my father wasn't actually the initial impetus for the poem. It was around the time that Obama was running for his first election. And I don't know if you recall, there was a moment when Jesse Jackson was caught on a hot mic saying something very threatening to about what he would do to Barack Obama. And it just struck me as kind of emblematic as this generational tension that exists in many senses, not in all senses, certainly. And, you know, I'm thinking about your conversation with Tracy earlier and the ways that naming our emotions is a way of healing. And so I wanted this poem to look inward and try to explore the ways we are all interconnected, the ways we are all interdependent, certainly, and the ways that we may be harming one another just in just in our thought patterns. That's another thing that I think poetry is very good at doing.
Yeah, Kevin, let me get you back in on the conversation. It's a beautiful and in many ways kind of a devastating poem, at least as I read it and heard it. What do you hear from Gregory Pardlow? What do you hear in his poetry?
Well, I think in this poem, you very much hear the ways that it's also a poem about other artworks, whether it's Marvin Gaye's music or Diddy's music. And it harkens back to the origins of Raisin in the Sun, which is actually in poetry, and Mike Hughes's long poem montage of A Dream Deferred. And hearing Pardlow's riffing on Raisin in the Sun, riffing on Langston Hughes, I'm really struck by the ways that there's a continuity in Black poetry and in Black culture. He's also using that to talk about discontinuities and difficulties. And I think that struggle and that song are really joined in this poem, but in all of his poems. And indeed, I think he's exemplary of the power of poetry today and also the power of Black poetry through time.
There was a question I asked you earlier in the hour, but unfortunately, Kevin, you couldn't hear me. But we've had a chance to hear three, and you also have a poem in this book as well from three living African-American poets. Are we in a kind of renaissance of Black poetry, Kevin Young?
Yes, I think absolutely we are. We very much are. There's a rich tradition. Gregory is one of our shining lights and one of many people who, just to take an example, has won the Pulitzer Prize in recent years. And I think that's really a sign of poetry's richness. But I also see it, you know, after such a difficult summer, as a poetry editor of The New Yorker, I saw lots of poems by poets that were really able to talk about the moment. And Black poetry, I think you see this even in Raisin, is able to balance the complications of today, yesterday, what we're all going through, and able to name it. And that naming, I think, is something that the renaissance of Black poetry right now, which I think extends to other things, Black film, Black television even, is really rich. And I think it's an exciting time to be writing. It's an exciting time to be an editor.
How about for you, Gregory? And you came, and I'm using quotations here on the radio, but kind of later in life. You were, what, in your 30s when you began to write poetry. True?
That's right. But I certainly came to poetry through studying the Harlem Renaissance. And as an undergrad, I remember taking a trip up to New York to visit the Schomburg Library, in fact, to study Langston Hughes. And I was really enamored by the community that was created through poetry, through literature. And I wanted to join that community. I wanted to join that tradition and that conversation, right? And I think this is, as we've been talking about earlier, with Major, this conversation has been going on for a very long time and will continue to go on for a very long time. So I'm actually of the feeling that there might not be so much a renaissance right now, but other than, or rather than a recognition of the richness that has existed all along. And unfortunately, I think some of that recognition comes from the tragic events of the summer and the kind of reckoning that we're, the global reckoning that we're experiencing now.
Well, Gregory Pardlow, just a pleasure to have you back with us on Radio Times. Thanks for joining the conversation.
Marty, it's always great to talk to you.
Thanks very much. And that's Gregory Pardlow. He's director of the MFA program at Rutgers University in Camden. Won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry for his collection Digest. And he's featured in this new anthology, African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. Kevin, I wonder if you had mentioned Lucille Clifton, and I wonder if you could read from this new anthology a poem that she wrote called Study the Masters.
Absolutely. You know, I think I was fortunate enough to, know Lucille and see the way that she worked in the world. And a poem like Study the Masters, I think, really thinks about the complications of history and tradition, while also celebrating them. Study the Masters. Study the Masters, like my Aunt Timmy. It was her iron, or one like hers, that smoothed the sheets the master poet slept on. Home or hotel, what matters is he lay himself down on her handiwork and dreamed. She dreamed too, words, some Cherokee, some Maasai, and some huge and particular as hope. If you had heard her chanting as she ironed, you would understand form and line and discipline and order and America.
Hmm. That's a poem by Lucille Clifton, Study the Masters. Again, it's included in Kevin Young's book that he edited called African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. That last line, and America, is just devastating.
Yeah, I mean, I think she really takes this, moment of someone working behind the scenes, ironing, but that is just as important. But then she also reminds us that that she has her own poetry, her own words, some Cherokee, some Maasai, and some huge in particular as hope, another great line. And she's trying to get us to think about, who do we consider masters? Who do we consider both masters in the slavery sense, but I think in a broader sense of who do we allow mastery over language? Who do we allow to be recognized, as Greg was mentioning? And I think that recognition that she's providing Aunt Timmy is also one she's also hoping that America will provide, and that she also is helping us understand that Timmy understands already about America.
And I wonder, just we've lived through, several years of, frankly, people abusing language and using language to lie. And I wonder whether poetry is tough enough as a corrective. Can poetry fight back?
I mean, I think poetry tells truth. It sometimes tells exquisite lies, or maybe it tells the truth, but tells it slant. But what it does is it asks us to hear. And so I do think in that way, if it can get us to listen, to think about form and line and discipline and order and America, like these poems and like Lucille Clifton's poems do, I think, yes, then it can help us hear each other, but also I think maybe heal a little bit. There's an element of healing in Lucille Clifton's work. And she used to say all the time that poetry's job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And that kind of combination, I think, is really powerful. And you see it throughout her work and throughout the anthology.
I mean, those are words that guide journalism today. Kevin, let me quote something else you said. And again, just in preparation, I ran across some really terrific quotes, including, I think you should meet a poem much like you should meet a person, a little bit open. Sometimes we forget that. And a poem is a good reminder. You have to meet it where it lives. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, I especially saw that sometimes with my students, is they would be super critical or judgmental or, you know, focus on the poem's flaws instead of what it was trying to do. And I think we have to, you know, be a bit more generous with each other and with poems. And I think that oftentimes a poem, you know, needs a little time. You know, it might strike us first with its music, but then it's struggle, it's deepening song hits us on a second and third read. And one thing I think, you know, there's so many horrible things in this time, but sometimes we have a little bit more time and we can maybe read a poem a second time, and we can be more generous on our first read and on our second and third read and understand what the poem's trying to reach at. And some of it is mysterious even to the poet. So hearing it aloud, I think, helps, and hearing it again can help us, you know, reach those deeper parts of the poem.
We're almost out of time, but I don't want to let the hour go by without just asking you about the fact that you're going to be the new director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. What does a poet bring to that job?
Well, I think poetry is a way of making connections. As you've heard this past hour, I think a way of thinking about history in new ways. And there are some things that the museum, I think, does so well. I really enjoyed from afar the museum's opening and its transformation, I think, of what we understand about African-American culture. It's a culmination in some ways. But I'm also excited to be up close and to having been through the museum to see the way that people connect in an everyday way, their own history and African-American history to broader American history. And you can see yourself in the museum in a way that I think is really powerful. I know when I saw, Harriet Tubman's earliest known picture, where there she is sitting defiant and young, it really puts a bone in one's back, you know. And I think at the same time, looking ahead, I'm really eager to see the ways that we can reach people about this time, thinking about it, collecting it, but also reach people in a digital way, which I think is very necessary for all institutions moving forward. How do we reach people, much like a poem does, where they live, and bring that history to them? And something I think the museum has done really well, and I look forward to it doing it more.
Well, Kevin Young, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And the book is African American Poetry, 250 Years of Struggle and Song. This is Christmas Comes Once a Year by Amos Milburn.
You'll take the next 6 months to pay the bills. Every time I think about it, it gives me chills. But I don't care. Christmas comes but once a year. I'm getting ready to have myself a ball. Ooh, going dancing and partying at every call. Gonna bend the pop till a New Year's Day. And I don't care what I have to pay. Let the good times roll. Christmas comes but once a year.